Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown, out on the edge of the prairie. It's been warm there. It's been up in the 30s, so the snow's been melting and dripping off the icicles, and the sidewalks are clear, and it gets light later, earlier and earlier, and later and later. So we have the promise of spring coming on, and we also have these animals who are coming into our yards, coming in out of the woods looking for food, these wild turkeys, ungainly creatures, no brain whatsoever, just nervous systems with legs. Moving in towards the house, awkwardly, ugly things. You have to question God's judgment when you look at a wild turkey. Just why? What is that for? What purpose does it serve? See some Tom Turkey and his whole harem of bimbos coming into your yard. Without fear, without common sense, you look around, and they come up close to you, and they brush up against you, and they won't go away. You clap your hands, and they will not leave. There's something that has broken down in the genetics of this animal somehow, and they really sorely try your patience. They find your bird feeder, and they go out, and they just suck it dry. They're like vacuum cleaners. They take it all down, and then they roost up on top of your car and leave trails of green poop across it. It's a terrible thing, the wild turkey. I tell you, people have never committed aggression in their lives, never fired a gunshot in anger. They would go after a wild turkey. I think people for the ethical treatment of animals might grab a softball bat after a little bit of exposure. St. Francis himself, I think, would not have cared if a wild turkey had flown up into his outstretched arms. He would have strangled it with his own hands. And then there are deer. Deer come out of the woods. They're looking for forage, and they're going to find it in your yard. They're going to roost in your rose garden, your flower garden. They're going to brush aside the snow, and they're going to look for green shoots under there. And when you move towards them to yell at them, they don't get up and they don't walk away. They just look at you with a look in their eyes that says, "I have ticks. I have deer ticks." I have thousands of deer ticks. You lay one hand on me, you're going to get Lyme's disease like you wouldn't believe. You're going to go for a year thinking it's influenza. It's not influenza. You're going to be an invalid for years, lying in a dim room with a cold compress on your forehead. You touch me, you back away, and you do back away. And so your flower garden is their salad bar. Deer own our town virtually in the month of March and April, and then they find other things to do off in the woods for which they need privacy. I have no idea what that would be. There was a boy who we suspected of having Lyme's disease. We thought he had something he'd picked up in the woods. He was a strange kid, the Jansky kid. He was the younger brother of Lyle Jansky, who teaches biology up at the high school. This was Alan Jansky. He was special. His mother thought he was special. His mother was his promoter, his cheerleader, his protector. She thought he was special. We thought it was pathological. He'd been bitten by a tick somewhere and picked up some sort of virus that made him odd. But how do you tell a person that what they think is an ability may be an illness, actually? The family was in the floor sanding business. He was not much good at it. He needed a lot of supervision. He got to be 21 and 24 and 25, and he was going nowhere. People didn't know what was going to become of him. And then his father died. John Jansky died suddenly, had a brain tumor. 1 week he was working. A week later he was in the hospital. 2 weeks later he was dead. Mrs. Jansky ordered a tombstone for her husband, a double tombstone for the two of them. John Jansky, 1925 to 1986, it said. And then she was Barbara Jansky, 1928 to 19 blank blank. Well, it infuriated her. How did the tombstone company assume that she was going to die in the 20th century? She went to court to get them to change it, and it took her a long time, and when she was in court, she had an aneurysm. They changed it to 20 blank blank, and then she died in 1989. So he lost his mother and his father. He got a little bit of money from the sale of the house, and he headed for California, as many people do who don't quite know what to do with themselves. headed out to California, and he landed there in Santa Barbara, named for his mother. He really loved it there. He got a job driving a van for a fancy hotel, and he was good at that. He was good at picking people up at the airport and taking them back to the hotel and picking up people at the hotel and taking them to the airport and making small talk with them and being charming for 15 minutes at a time. He was good at that, and he loved California. The climate was like God's blessing made manifest on us all. He adored the costume, shorts and sandals and a t-shirt. That's all he ever wore, summer, fall, winter, spring. He had a room there at the hotel. He had a good life, a good, good life, and a little extra money, and everything was all set for Alan. He had a massage twice a week at the hotel spa, lie down on a comfortable massage bed and smell eucalyptus. And you just, it was like what you imagine heaven would be, to smell eucalyptus and an angel pours oil on your back and rubs it into your skin. When you think about death, especially people from Minnesota, that's what we think of. We're carried up out of the snow and the ice and the dark and the clouds, and we're taken to Santa Barbara and we're laid out and eucalyptus oil is poured on our back. He was having a massage one day, and the headrest broke as he was lying there, and suddenly his head snapped back as if he were on the guillotine and being executed. It snapped back. He was lying on his belly, and it just snapped. His head fell forward, and the screw that held the pad cut him across his throat. He was taken to the hospital, and he was put in a back and neck brace. And he walked around now with his head erect for the first time in his life. People from the Midwest walk slumped over. We look down at the ground. We seldom look at the sky, which is just not worthy of it somehow. And we're brought up to be self-effacing. And so we look down at the ground, snow and ice and gravel. This is our world, really. That's why I'm in radio. Poor eye contact, really. Never could make it in television. So for the first time with this neck brace, he could look straight ahead, and it just changed his whole view of everything. He thought about his mother, how she had prayed for him in her last years, and how she had looked to the Lord for answers for her beloved Alan, her special child. And she was praying for romance, for a wife for him. She was waiting for the Lord to send her the answer. The Lord had told her it would be a woman in green, but the Lord didn't go beyond that. And she knew that somehow Alan had a special future somewhere. Here he was in Santa Barbara in a neck brace, looking straight ahead, and now feeling like a prince, like a king of all he surveyed. He had a very nice cash settlement from the spa for his injury, and it was enough to start a restaurant in memory of his mother, the Cafe Barbara, on the main street of Santa Barbara, a restaurant that would serve all of the foods that she had served to him in his childhood in Lake Wobegon. He found a woman named Green to manage it, Marcia Green. He was waiting for her to show up in a green outfit. She never did. He had plenty of money, $100,000 settlement from the spa. It was enough to keep the cafe running for 2.5 months. Somehow people did not go for Spanish rice in Santa Barbara. They did not go for tuna noodle casserole, even when it was fresh tuna and it was cooked medium rare. They just didn't go for it. And the nutty nougat caramel coconut bar, they didn't care for that so much. And he didn't have a wine license, was a problem. He lost his shirt on the cafe in memory of his mother. But it was okay. He's from California. He goes with whatever happens. He lives in the moment. He's here in the day. He got a call from Lyle back in Minnesota just about 2 weeks ago, saying, "Mother left you a large envelope, a manila envelope with your name on it. Do you want me to open it and tell you what it is?" "No," he said, "no. I'm going to come out and open it myself. Don't mail it. I want to come and see it." So he flew back to Minnesota with the last of his savings, and he rented a car at the airport, and he drove north towards Lake Wobegon. This was Monday morning. There was a thick fog. It was like corn chowder driving through a thick soup to get to Lake Wobegon. He called Lyle on the phone, and Lyle directed him into town. He would have missed it otherwise. You couldn't even see the grain elevators. You couldn't see the steeple of Our Lady Perpetual Responsibility or the Lutheran Church. You couldn't see anything at all. He wound up at Lyle's house. Lyle handed him the manila envelope. He opened it slowly, expecting he wasn't sure what. He found four books of green bond trading stamps. She'd gotten them years ago from the SuperValue. And there was a note from Mother. It said, "Alan, buy yourself a chafing dish. Love, Mother." That was all she had left him. He got in his car. He was so heartbroken. He drove, and now he was lost. He got outside of town in thick fog. He couldn't see anything. He had to slow down, looking for landmarks, couldn't find them. And now he heard a crunching sound under the wheels of his car, and he realized he was driving on ice. He was out on the lake. He couldn't see. He pulled up. He stopped. He got out of the car. He could hear the ice cracking. The left front tire sank 2 inches in the ice. "Oh, my God," he thought. And then he heard wild turkeys calling to him. He heard their voice from over there, and he walked in pure faith across the ice in this white fog, this blankness. And soon he was on solid ground again, surrounded by turkeys. There were 20 of them. He walked down the road, and he stepped in a pothole. It was a deep pothole, and it jarred his neck again, and he re-injured his old dislocated neck so that now his chin was down against his chest. He could not look up at all. He could just look down at the ground the way he was used to walking. He walked, and then he heard a woman's voice saying, "Are you all right? Do you need help? Do you need me to call for somebody?" He walked towards her. He could see that she was wearing green pants. She led him towards her house. They walked up a walk and through a gate and into the door, up the porch and into the house. It was warm. He couldn't lift his head at all. And now he saw that her pants were not green. They were blue. He had mistaken them. "Oh, my God," he thought. "My God." But he called up Lyle. He called him up on the cell phone. And Lyle came and got him. There were deer all over, deer all over. He remembered a deer from his childhood, a deer that had come up and befriended him. This all came back to him suddenly, where it all started years ago in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, where it has been a quiet week this last week. That's the news, where all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the children are above average.